Well, Brother Malcolm will now lead our thoughts on the subject unto this day. Brother Malcolm.
It's really interesting how ideas come around and come back to you as time goes on. And it's interesting for me, the number of ideas which were sort of came into my thinking when we developed a Bible display earlier this year. And the whole question began to come up very much, just what was the basis of the text that we were reading? Just how could we rely on the text of our Bibles? How old was it? And questions like this. Because this really is the foundation of our faith. Now, Christadelphians, as a group, have always sort of looked at this matter of the of critics of the Bible. When I was a teenager, for instance, there were a whole group of old brethren that used to get on the platform and rail on about the higher critics periodically. And if you remember this group, which came to be known as the higher critics, they really sprang out of the mid-1800s and sort of culminated around 1900. And they really were one of the first groups that seriously started to take the Bible text apart. And they came up with all sorts of bits and pieces, like the use of the word clock in the Old Testament, which was obviously wrong. They didn't have clocks in those days. So how did the word get there? Well, obviously the text had been vandalized in some way and couldn't be relied upon. Other little points, we'll come to Achan a little later on, and the story of Jericho very briefly a little later on in our talk this evening. And Achan, of course, found a Babylonish garment in Jericho. Now, he couldn't possibly have found a Babylonish garment because Babylon didn't exist at the time when Jericho was destroyed. And so on. There were all these little things that came up out of the higher critics. And, most of you, I see several of you smiling at this point because all of you realize that the word clock is a mistranslation. And the word Babylon, which is there for Achan's garment, didn't necessarily refer to Babylon. It simply referred to an area which is more or less where Babylon was. And so what was really happening in the text, with the way we read it, and this point was made by many commentators, that what we're really doing was pointing out something which was there in biblical history all along, and that is that you have to realize where you've come from and where the problems in your life come from. So that was really the force of the subject which was there. Now, another idea which keeps cropping up every now and again, and which one or two people in the audience mentioned to me some years ago, and which we had for a Bible class topic because of this, was this matter of missing books of the Bible. And this, of course, is something that the Mormons put a lot of faith on. They look at all these. I think there's, 21 books? I can't remember the number exactly. Books which are mentioned in the Old Testament, which are actually not there as titles in our Bible. So the whole thought then is that the Bible text has been mangled and corrupted and all sorts of things have happened to it. On the one hand, if you're a critic, but on the other hand, if you're a Mormon, what that proves is that there are all sorts of other books, and so why shouldn't there be another one nowadays, which is the Book of Mormon? So really what this highlights to us is the overall question of how reliable is our Old Testament text. And this little phrase, which we are going to look at shortly, unto this day. Another way of putting that, of course, would be, and it's still there, the pile of stones, which we read about, which commemorated the crossing of the Jordan, could be seen at some point in time until somebody's day. It was still there when that comment was inserted into the text at a later time. So a number of years ago, when this matter sort of dropped into my mind, I took it up to my dad and said, well, what do you think? What about all these missing books of the Bible? And his comment was, they're not missing. They're all there. And we'll come to this in a second. But his other comment was that, well, because they're there, somebody put them there. And if they were put there by somebody like Ezra, then what Dad said was that he personally had no difficulty with whatever had been written into the text if it was written by someone with Ezra's credentials. And if we think about this for a moment, what it's really saying is that our Bible was brought together from a number of different sources. And let's just look at a few of those now before we actually come to this phrase, unto this day, because it's part of the same question. 2 Chronicles 9 and 29, we have a whole list of things. Now, the rest of the Acts of Solomon, first and last, are they not written in the book of Nathan the prophet? Now, we don't have a book entitled Nathan, but we have somewhere close to 20 chapters which cover the writings and the sayings and the actions of Nathan the prophet. They start in Samuel, and they walk right on through to the very beginnings of Kings. And what we have, the period of time which is covered there, is from the beginning of the reign of David, and David reigned for 40 years, and Solomon took over from David after 40 years, so that Nathan was an active prophet for, let's say, 41 years. And what he said and what he did and many of the things which can be assigned to Nathan are here for us in these books of Samuel and in the beginning of the book of Kings. And Nathan the prophet, you remember, was there at the inauguration of the temple, of Solomon's temple. So he was obviously, and from the prophecies and the words of the Lord which were delivered from Nathan, obviously a sound and a reliable individual. And his words were recorded in his book, the book of Nathan the prophet. And so what happened apparently later on was that somebody took those words and incorporated them into a much larger and longer chapter. A much longer scroll. The books of Nathan the prophet. And in the prophecy of Ahijah, the Shilonite, and in the visions of Edo, the seer, against Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. So there we have three books which cover the doings of Solomon. And Edo the seer is also mentioned in the 12th chapter of 2 Chronicles, 15th verse, if you want to just note it quickly. And there Edo is given credit as a genealogist, someone who wrote down the genealogies. And in the 13th chapter of Chronicles and the 22nd verse, we have a phrase which is almost exactly the same as the one here in 2 Chronicles 9. So Edo was a seer. He kept the genealogy, which was the basis of Jewish society, the basis of the priestly lineage, the basis of the land grants which people enjoyed. This was a very important and a very critical thing for the development of Jewish society. So he also can only be considered a reliable individual. And the other one which was there was a prophet, Ahijah. So we're not dealing with people that have no credentials when we look at these missing books. Now, the Acts of David, we're now going back a chapter or two, and right at the end of 1 Chronicles, in the last couple of verses of the book of 1 Chronicles. 1 Chronicles 29 and 29. Now, the Acts of David the king, first and last, behold, they are written in the book of Samuel the seer, and in the book of Nathan the prophet, and in the book of Gad the seer. Now, Gad we meet on a number of other occasions, the way we met Edom. Someone who was actually a reliable recorder of events and the sayings of the different prophets throughout this period. And Nathan, we've met it before, and Samuel we know about. And so what we're told here was that Samuel's events, Samuel's sayings, were also recorded. And then to wind this little point up, we want to go back into 1 Kings, going to look 1 Kings 11 and 41. If you want to look it up, I'll read it for you, 1 Kings 11 and 41. And the rest of the Acts of Solomon and all that he did and all his wisdom, are they not written in the book of the Acts of Solomon? And the time that Solomon reigned was 40 years, and he slept with his fathers, and then the story goes on. So what was the mechanism by which this these Old Testament, these historical books were drawn together. And also, if you work your way through Kings, 1st and 2nd Kings, you find several references to the chronicles of the kings of Judah. And you also find many more references to the chronicles of the kings of Israel. So what we have then are sort of secular records of what the kings did on the one hand, and we have prophetic records from people like Nathan, Gad, Iddo, and so forth, who kept the word that had been delivered to the people from God by these prophets. And those things, those different sayings, were all worked together along with the straight historical records of the time that the kings reigned and so forth. Now, the thing that we need to realize, and it's a point which I tried to draw to your attention on Sunday morning, is that we don't have the sort of ordinary history. This is not even a history which is representative of the period in which it, of the period that it came from. The Egyptians were, when they wrote history from this same interval, were writing grand and glorious things. Each one of the pharaohs was a superman in many respects. He won enormous battles almost single-handedly. He erected enormous monuments almost single-handedly. All of these things were assigned directly to the pharaoh. And that was the type of history which was contemporary with the history that was written by other people at the time when our Old Testament histories were, historical books were being brought together. So we have something else which is really remarkable about these texts. Not that the events were recorded and kept deliberately and kept as part of a temple record and looked at periodically, which is the point which we're coming to shortly, and looked at very carefully on those occasions, but also that it's the histories are here with all the warts and so forth. David was not a superman, even though he did many things which were, we would consider, beyond our normal abilities. He was a very competent guerrilla warrior. He was also quite an astute administrator when he became king. And yet he's there with all his warts and all the problems and all the weaknesses of a human being. And so we realize that we're dealing with ordinary people when we pick up our Bible. Even when we pick up a Bible talking about things which happened, oh, close to 3,000 years ago, which is what we're looking at here now. And one last point, that when you consider the time frame that these historical books, if you want to go back to Joshua, as far back as Joshua, where we're looking at now, you've got at least 1,500 years of history that couldn't have been covered by any one individual. It had to have been covered by people who kept these records, who read them carefully at intervals, who looked at what was there, at what it meant to people, and what it should mean, and what it represented in their lives. And that's one of the points which we get when we start looking specifically at the little phrase which I want to draw to your attention tonight, unto this day, as it is recorded in the translation which I like to use. So, our Old Testament, the historical sections were woven together carefully. Scribes picked them up, rewrote them in part, certainly transcribed them regularly, and added little comments which brought things to people's attention and which made the record which they were looking at come alive and come and have some specific meaning to those people who walked around and who looked at things and experienced things and realized that the events and circumstances and practices that were going on in their lives all had come from somewhere, and they all had some significance in the retention of their culture, as we say nowadays, or of their way of life. Now, back to Ezra and to Nehemiah and to that time for just a second, because there's an interesting little point which lots has been written of many years, and that's that little phrase in Nehemiah that when they read the word of the Lord, that they gave the sense. We've written tons about that phrase. There's all sorts of discussions about whether they could actually understand the Hebrew language at that time because of their time spent in Babylon and in Persia. and other ideas which have been brought to the fore with that regard. But one of the things I think we have to recognize is that as language changes, and as people's experience changes, you don't find it quite so easy to understand what's before you that comes from several hundred years ago. It's not easy for us to understand Shakespearean English. And if you go back much earlier than Shakespearean English, it's almost impossible for us to understand it. And so it is necessary. It is necessary to take the text and to make sure that people can understand the words that are in it. Now, the ideas which came around and which were current until, some 20, 30 years ago, were that much of our Old Testament originated from the time of Ezra or later. That very little of it was actually written much earlier than the time of Ezra. And that was because of these things that we talked about, you know, the ideas of the Babylonish garment and thoughts like that. Some of the occupations which are mentioned in the Old Testament have Persian names at a time before the Persians were there. There are Persian coins mentioned in the text before the Persia existed as a society. And so, to my way of thinking, and my dad before me, that what really you're looking at here is that someone with Ezra's authority made sure that the words in the text corresponded to experiences and to things which people could understand, could see, and could feel in their day. It was brought up to date, as we say, and brought up to date by people that had the hand of God leading and guiding their lives. Now, so let's go to this little phrase that is our title this evening. The phrase, unto this day, and I put in the program the 21st verse of the first book of Judges as an example of the use of that phrase. Now, this phrase is used some 43 times in the historical sections of the Bible. It's used another, 6 references that are in Genesis, there's one in Ezekiel, and there's 10 references in Chronicles that the scholars feel should be applied to a hand other than the hand that we're, the scribe that we're looking at the moment. Now, the thought that scribes should actually go back and correct the text and make sure that it really is up to snuff is portrayed for us very clearly in the Dead Sea Scrolls, where there's one passage in Jeremiah where a section was left out, and the another hand, a hand which is present in several of the scrolls, is obviously a senior scribe, went back and wrote in the missing piece, and he started off writing between the lines. When he ran out of space, he wrote down the side of the page. And when he ran out of space again, he wrote on the bottom of the script, upside down this way, so that the whole section was added in. It's proof for us of how diligent the scribes were in going over the scrolls that they dealt with. And it was still going on in the second, in around 200 BC. So, to this little phrase here, which, as I say, because it sort of stands out, it's still going on. This is at the end of the 21st chapter, 21st verse of this first chapter of Judges. That little phrase, unto this day. What really means is that somebody had looked at the text and said it and put the phrase in and said, you can still see it. And when you see what's going on here, you should realize that there are reasons for that being there. You should realize that there's what you're seeing in front of you, and in this case, it's the inhabit the Jebusites, which dwelt with the children of Benjamin in Jerusalem. The Jebusites are still there. They weren't completely destroyed, as the instructions had been when Joshua led the tribes across Jordan, as we read in the reading a little while ago. They were still there, and they were with the Israelites unto this day. Now, we're now starting to see something of the mindset of what this phrase carries for us. We're talking about this whole question that we started out with reading there from the time when Joshua led the tribes across Jordan, and the pile of stones was there and could still be seen when the writer added the phrase, you can still see them there, he said at one point in history. And the Jebusites, there are still foreigners in Jerusalem unto this day. So on the one hand, there was the evidence, the physical evidence, that they had actually crossed Jordan. There was the physical evidence that they had actually entered the land as a unified group of people. 12 stones. Each represented something. And you could go back and see each one of those stones in that pile. Now, we come to more piles of stones a little later on, so there must have been some way in which they constructed those stones so that one would recognize it as a memorial. So that one would then say, why is this pile of stones here? It's the question that was raised, you know, when Passover feast was read. Why do we do this? Well, there's a reason for it. There's a reason for the stones being there, and the people must recognize that and realize that it was evidence of God's mercy towards them. And when they get to this question of the Jebusites still being in Jerusalem, they must realize that that was evidence of their own ineffectiveness, their own inability to do as God had said. So these two ideas are built up, but they're religious ideas. They're ideas which demonstrate that indeed God was part of their background, and their ideas which demonstrate that there are times when they fell down in their duty toward God. They are strong religious ideas which are carried and driven home when that little phrase appears. Somebody, and I believe that that somebody had the hand of God on them as they wrote, put it in because the people needed to remember and be reminded of those things. 26th verse, lead into the 27th verse of this same chapter. The phrase is there right at the end of that same verse, right at the end of the 26th verse. And what we're looking at here is somebody who collaborated with the Israelites when they were cleaning the land and moving into it. He was allowed to escape with his family. He went and outside the boundaries of the nation of Israel as it was set up in the time of Joshua, here at the beginning of Judges, that he actually then established a geographical entity which carried his name. So if you were traveling on business, if you were trading with somebody and you went up into that northern coast, which is towards the area of Lebanon to this day, and you came across a town with this name, you would remember that we were again commemorating the fact that the Israelites had crossed Jordan, come into their land, and taken possession of at least part of that countryside. There's in Judges, there are several references. There's the name of a city, there's an altar which Gideon built. There's the land of Gilead. There's a spring which was established in the time of Samson. And place names, all of which commemorate something in the development of the nation of this nation of Israel. I want to look at the sixth chapter of Judges quickly. We can't look at all of these 40-some verses. 24th verse. Oh, incidentally, we're not going to look at any of the ones in Genesis. And Gideon built an altar there unto the Lord, called it Jehovah Shalom. Unto this day, it is yet in Ophrah of the Abi Ezerites. And Gideon built an altar, and you can still see the altar unto this day that there's record was made, was changed, was edited. Again, it was something which was an integral part of Jewish worship and something which was central to their religious life and something which drove home the fact that God had been fighting on their behalf. That when they had faith As was the case with Gideon, and you remember that that was a remarkable military achievement, which followed the building of this altar, and the realization that foreign altars shouldn't belong there. One was broken down, and Gideon's was built up, and it was still there, and you could see it, and you could realize what had happened, that God had been part of their lives, had been their deliverer, and that they should remember this in the years to come. And whenever they went back to that area, looked at this, presumably this similarly built pile of stones, that they would realize that God had been on their side at that time. We've looked at Joshua 4, and not so maybe we don't need to look at it anymore. But in the end of that ninth verse, then Joshua, that's right. The fourth chapter of Joshua there, at the end of the ninth verse. I'm looking in the wrong chapter, that's why I'm lost. Joshua 4 and 9. And there, there's a pile of stones, there's 12 stones in there, what must have been a recognizable structure could be seen and was visible for many years previous, many years following that event. In Joshua 5, we meet the term Gilgal, which has its name, Joshua 5 and 9, unto this day. In Joshua 6 and verse 25th verse, we talk about the descendants of Rahab, which were part of their society unto that same that day. So Rahab's descendants were still in their land and could be recognized. And this we can understand fully because genealogy, again, was the basis of Jewish society. And so trace your family history back, and it was obvious where Rahab and where her descendants had come from. And Rahab, of course, is interesting because she turns up in a much greater genealogy later on. In the seventh chapter, we have the story which we alluded to a few moments ago of Achan and his Babylonish garment and the gold which he kept for himself and the troubles that that brought on the nation of Israel. And Achan was then killed and a monument raised over his body, which could be seen unto that day. That's in verse 7, chapter 7, and the heap of stones is referred to in verse 26. Wherefore the name of the place was called the Valley of Achor unto this day. So the monument and the location was there, and the name of the valley, whenever they would travel through that and they realized, where are you? Well, you're in Achor. They had to, it would remind them of what had happened when this nation first came across the Jordan and took the first city which they encountered, the city of Jericho. I want to look at chapter 9 for a minute. And verse 27. We're talking here about the Gibeonites. The children of Israel journeyed and came unto the cities. I'm in the 17th verse now. Now their cities were Gibeon, Chephrah, Beeroth, Kirjath Jearim. Children of Israel smote them not, because the princes of the congregation had sworn unto them by the Lord God of Israel. And the congregation murmured against the princes. But, so you read this little bit just to remind you of the circumstances where the Gibeonites came and pleaded with Joshua and his army not to destroy them. And the end result was that because they then were foreigners in the nation of Israel, that Joshua made them that day, in the 27th verse now, hewers of wood and drawers of water for the congregation and for the altar of the Lord, even unto this day. And here's another phrase which happens with several of these occurrences of this little phrase, unto this day, in the place which he should choose. This combination of phrases happens in a number of circumstances. And it happens almost exclusively when we're talking about temple service. It happens almost exclusively when we're talking about the ritual of worship surrounding the service in the temple. So that these two phrases then indicate that this thing is still going on, that these people were still bringing supplies for the for the service of the temple, even though this had originally been set in place when the tabernacle was there in the wilderness, and many years later when the temple was established, you could still see these people carrying out their same function. So maybe we should just sort of step aside a moment for this, because we're getting now to really see the main point which the individual who inserted this little phrase unto this day had in mind. He's very concerned, firstly, with the fact that the people recognized that God had brought them into the position that they were in. Also very much concerned that these people should recognize that they were dependent on God for their continued existence. And little things like the monuments, and we'll see a couple more as we work our way through these verses, that the monuments then should remind them of that. That they were also to be realized that their existence then was dependent upon worship in the temple. And so this leads, at least the one scholar that I've been looking at quite closely in recent days, to the thought that these words probably were written in the, inserted, these little phrases were probably inserted in and around the time of Josiah. Now that, of course, is interesting, because we've gone within the last 50 years from most scholars feeling that most of the Old Testament was very new, was written about the 4th century B.C., between the 4th and the 1st centuries B.C. Then later on we came to realize that what probably had happened about 40, 50 years ago, the idea became current that probably what was happened mostly was that someone like Ezra had edited much of the text around 400 B.C., which meant that the text then had to be in existence probably as early as 500 B.C., Now we're looking at scholars that tell us, well, what obviously happened was that the text was edited in and around the year 630 BC, which means then that because of the strong allusions in there to the time of Hezekiah, which really can be laid down very clearly with archaeological data and so forth, and because of the internal evidence that indeed there were manuscripts, and there were records which went back much earlier than that, the chronicles of the kings of Israel, the chronicles of the kings of Judah, the internal evidence from the text then would suggest that this text is at least as old as 8th century BC. So it's quite fascinating that the scholars are getting closer and closer to things which we have taken for granted as a group for a long time. I mean, if we think about what little phrases like this little insertion here that we're talking about, what it means, that when somebody writes in there a little phrase like, and you can still see it, or they're still doing it, what does it mean? Well, it means that somebody added it later. Well, what does that do? Well, it definitely tells us, when the scholars look at this, that this text is older than they had have thought and they had been willing to defend some years previously. And then when you look at things like the Tel Dan inscription, which we have a replica of in our Bible exhibition, it's quite evident that the hard aspects of the text go back at least to the 11th century BC. And then when you can find from about the 12th century BC the little phrase that benediction, the Lord bless thee and keep thee, can find that in tombs which date back to at least the 12th century BC. It's quite obvious that there was written text going back at least that far. So, as I say, that's an aside to what we're really looking at here. But it's fascinating that the more people talk about it, that now in scholarly circles we're going back further and further to the thoughts and the ideas that have been part of our belief set for a long time. Joshua 10:27, there's a Vikings, okay. Yeah, let's look at this one for just a moment. We're not doing badly for time. The actual phrase, unto this day, which remained there unto this day, is the last few words of the 27th verse of the 10th chapter of Joshua. So that monument was put in the entrance to a cave, and they were still there for many years later. And what the monument then reminded people was this fight which went on between Gibeon and the five kings. And Adonizer, where are we now? Therefore, the five kings, the Amorites, in the fifth verse, king of Jerusalem, king of Hebron, Yarmuth, Lachish, and Eglon, gathered themselves together, went up, they and all their hosts, and camped before Gibeon and made war. The men of Gibeon sent unto Joshua to the camp, saying, slack not thy mouth, thy hand from thy servants, come to us quickly. And Joshua ascended from Gilgal, he and all the people of war with him, and the mighty men of valor. And of course, they were successful in their military encounter. But what this then brought to mind were the difficulties that this people had had when they did move into their land. The problems that were there because there were still Jebusites in Jerusalem, as we've said, and they were still there. And that phrase was marked with the phrase, unto this day. And the problems that were incumbent on this people and which they did not deal with properly were evidence. But there's a pile of stones there in the entrance to this cave which raised very definitely the notion that it was possible for them to succeed in establishing themselves in their kingdom with God's help and when they worked together, when they worked together as a people. Now, if you look at the geographic distribution of the things that are marked by this little phrase, unto this day, certainly in these historical books that we're looking at, this book's from Joshua on to most of the way through Kings and in Chronicles. If you look at the geographical distribution of those utterances of this phrase, they're almost all surrounding the area of Jerusalem. They're obviously part of the kingdom of Judah. They extend as far south as Ziklag, which was a part of Benjamin's inheritance. And they extend just up north of Jerusalem and out towards the coast through the area that Samson was active in and judges of that nature. The area that Samuel was active in with his preaching also walks around this same zone where this little phrase is applied to monuments, to place names, and things of that sort. There are a couple of instances in the north where the phrase is applied. And they both deal with overthrowing the altars of Baal in the north and with an altar which was erected to God in the north and which was there and could be seen unto that day. And then they deal with the area that Solomon dealt away to Hiram, king of Tyre. And that area was also defined by this little phrase, unto this day, so that the geographic changes which took place in Solomon's day were also evident and were still there and could be noticed unto the day when this was spoken. Now, the next sort of major group of uses for this phrase is related to the ark. So, Originally, if you recall, when you go back into Deuteronomy, the phrase is probably most clearly, most definitely easiest to see, and because it's there in short language, that the Levites were given the task of carrying the ark, and the task which in Deuteronomy, it says, in the 10th chapter of Deuteronomy, it says that they carry out this task unto this day. That's the 8th verse of the 10th chapter of Deuteronomy. In 2 Kings, and this is where we're going to go now, 2 Kings 18, and in the 4th verse, we have really a somewhat problematic little verse. In the 3rd year of Hoshea, the son of Elah, king of Israel, Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, began to reign. 25 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 29 years. And he did that which was right. He removed the high places. 4th verse of the 18th chapter of 2 Kings. He removed the high places. Break the images, cut down the groves, break in pieces the brazen serpent that Moses had made. For unto those days, and it's the same phrase except in the plural, the children of Israel did burn incense into it and called it Nehushtan. And he trusted in the Lord God of Israel, so that after him was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor any that were before him. He removed the high places, break the images, cut down the groves, and broke in pieces the brazen serpent that Moses had made, because the children of Israel had turned it into a god of some form. And for up till that point in time is really the way it was meant. But the phrase, it's a favorite phrase, which occurs many times, was there applied, again, as we said, to another thing that was less than ideal in the way the Israelites were carrying out their business. We've already talked about Joshua 4 and 7th verse when the ark was carried across Jordan. And the Levites carried the ark across the Jordan. And that event was commemorated in that pile of stones which could be seen unto that day. And then when the ark was taken by the Philistines, you remember it was taken into battle and the Philistines became worried and afraid because, as they said, the Israelites' God has come into battle, and so we're sure to lose now because their God's here. But the fascinating thing really was that what was going on was that the Israelites had taken over the thinking of the people around them. That was exactly the way the Philistines thought, that when God was there with them in battle, they couldn't lose because their God was territorial. And their God then controlled this area. And as long as their God was strong, their God, their land was safe. And what the Israelites were then saying is, okay, we're going to pack our God down here and we're going to plant our God in your land. And so our God then will control your land. It was the thinking of the people around them. They had no longer considered God to be an invisible God, which was present in the whole world. And we have that point made for us in Moses, that God claimed the whole of the world, and that they were being given territory, because God could decide which territory they deserved, which territory they should have. It was God's world, and that was where God, that was the piece of it that God was giving them at that time. They did not understand that very basic point. They never had learned it, it seemed. So they took the ark into battle with the thinking that the Philistines had, that this God was territorial and was now laying claim to Philistine territory. There are three occasions where the phrase is used until this day, talking within the Philistine the Philistine surroundings. In the 8th chapter, 1 Kings 8, we're going to look at the 8th verse. And I don't want to go there yet. I'm going to go there in a moment. the place where the ark was steadied. That place name was named and emphasized, and the text talks about it being there until this day. The house of Dagon and things which went on there were are commemorated, and the things which went on there were going on unto that day. And and the place where the ark was stored was also named, and the name is still there unto that day. So there is a real concern about the ark and its central part in Jewish worship, and we see this when we come to the chapter which I just mentioned to you, 1 Kings 8 and the 8th verse. We're talking now about the dedication of the temple at the time of Solomon. And Solomon, in the first verse of this 8th chapter, assembled the elders of Israel and the tribes, chief the children of Israel, and King Solomon in Jerusalem, that they might bring up the ark of the covenant of the Lord out of the city of David. And the men of Israel assembled themselves, the elders of Israel came, the priests took up the ark. And here we're picking up the idea which was present in Deuteronomy, which was present when the children of Israel crossed Jordan, and which was commemorated when the children of Israel didn't carry the ark properly, when they mistreated it, and the ark's wanderings among the Philistines were commemorated in two different place names, and in the destruction of the house of Dagon, with the phrase, unto this day. So it's quite obvious that the writer of that little phrase was very concerned with the way the ark was conveyed, with what it meant to the nation of Israel, what its importance as a central feature in their worship. And he was also concerned with the fact that it be handled by the priests properly. Fifth verse, King Solomon and the congregation of Israel that were assembled were brought with him before the ark. Priests brought in the ark in the 6th verse, the ark of the covenant of the Lord unto this place, unto the oracle of the house, to the most holy place, even under the wings of the cherubim. For the cherubim spread forth their two wings over the place of the ark, and cherubims covered the ark, and the staves thereof above. And they drew out the staves, that the ends of the staves were seen out in the holy place before the oracle. And they were not seen without. And there they are, unto this day. And there's the phrase again. So, something again which was commemorated and which was critical to the idea that people should be held together as a nation, as a people, and that they be held together in service of their God. So far, we've seen two things. We've seen monuments which remind people of the history of Israel, places where they should remember and be grateful to the way God has brought them through the events of their past history. We've also seen that this phrase, unto this day, is very, very much concerned with the way the ark was handled and with the central place that the ark had in leading the nation and in the worship of this people. And now, one other thing, and this happens with about four different places where this phrase is used, this little phrase, unto this day. Second Kings 2 and verse 22. So the waters were healed unto this day, according to the saying of Elisha, which he spake. And we mentioned earlier the spring that came forth when Samson was thirsty, when he called to God and said, I need water, I just can't keep going. And the spring, he dug in the ground with his job, with the bone that he had in his hand, you recall. The spring came forth, and that spring then was named and could be seen unto this day. And here we're we're looking at spring again, which should remind people of the work of God, but which more than simply reminding them that God was there and that their history was intact and they should remember what had happened, they should remember Samson, for instance, what they should remember here was prophecy, that there was a prophetic saying from Elisha, that that prophecy now had been commemorated in this spring and the way the spring continued to flow. And when people drank from that spring, they should remember that God was providing in his word, in the prophecy, in the prophet works, in the prophetic utterances, which came from people that served God, that that was, as it were, and in Isaiah we get this concept, that living waters that really sustain people spiritually, as well as the water which sustained them mentally. So again, you see, the individual that inserts this little phrase continuously is looking at the spiritual welfare, the spiritual welfare of this people. Now, we mentioned that the phrase unto this day occurs with other phrases. There's another place, another phrase, which is brought in on, I think it's five, if I remember correctly, five different occasions. It's in Joshua 14 and the 14th verse. Another combination of phrases. We're talking here about Caleb in the 6th verse of the 14th chapter of Joshua. Then the children of Judah came unto Joshua in Gilgal, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, 40 years old, Caleb was saying when he came, and now behold, the Lord has kept me alive in the 10th verse, and yet I'm as strong this day as I was that Moses sent me. And Joshua blessed him and gave Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, Hebron for an inheritance. Hebron, therefore, became the inheritance of Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, the Kenizzite, unto this day, because that he wholly followed the Lord God of Israel. And the phrases there linked with this idea that it was there and remained there unto that day when this was written, unto that day because the one who did it wholly followed the word of God. So, in conclusion, what we started out by saying was that it's really quite interesting that there are all these lost books of the Bible, and yet they're not lost. They're all sort of, they're all here. They've been woven into an incomplete and an intact manuscript, a complete scroll which covered the certain period of history. And at one time, one of those scribes put little comments into the text. And as we said earlier, when you look at the people that are credited with actually writing this text, when you look at the names that are there in the text that these writings are accredited to, the ones that we know about were very reliable witnesses to God's word, were very reliable servants of God, and we should not then suspect or be concerned with the thought that somebody else has had a hand in writing this book. They were reviewed at regular intervals so that the text was kept up to date. People could understand it. And those who did it, we have every assurance from some of the phrases, some of the verses that we've looked at this evening, we have every assurance that those people were working fully with the hand of God upon them. So, personally, I have no, the works of the scholars and the critics which look at these things really don't bother me. I still feel that what we've got is an inspired text, even though more than one hand has obviously been involved in its transmission. And this one hand that we're looking at here, which seems responsible for most of these, because they're so similar in the way they use, so similar in the places that they're put, in this little phrase, unto this day, that this one individual and one scholar that I looked at seems to feel that he was active during the reign of Josiah. What that does then is indicate to us that the text that we're looking at goes back at least to the 7th century BC. Internal evidence that scholarly views are now accepting as fact would indicate then that our text is certainly quite a bit older than scholars had accepted some years previously. And as we said, when you look then at the way archaeological evidence is going in this regard, it seems quite apparent that the beliefs that we have, that our text does indeed indicate a reliable message, a reliable history, a reliable reference to the way God treated his people, that we can, that there's no reason to doubt that our set of beliefs are quite valid. So I hope you found that interesting. I know these thoughts have gone through my mind quite a bit since we got entangled into this question of a Bible exhibition earlier this summer. And as I say, it's fascinating to watch the scholars just gradually come closer and closer to the point of view that I had when I was a teenager.